Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 5. When I undressed to shower, I carefully examined my shirt for damage as well as blood stains. This examination, like my others lately, only puzzled me more. Someone had crudely cut a patch of fabric out of the blood-stained area. Why would someone... I let the question dangle when my muddled mind could only summon a satanic cult as the connecting link between the hole in my shirt, Monica, Harley, and the goat. Feeling the need for something normal to drive such unacceptable thoughts from my mind, I took a long shower and put on my most comfortable shorts and shirt. Then I sat at the kitchen table and organized my seminar material to take my mind off my aching head and throbbing arm. To say nothing of devil worship, Monica's relationship with her dog and the goat, and my impending meeting with Chandler McCarthy. "Yo, Cine!" A familiar, cheery voice hailed me when the front door opened later that morning. I greeted Joe Talbot with equal good cheer and gestured him toward the empty chair opposite mine at the kitchen table. Although I didn't start out to pump Joe, it did occur to me that someone with McCarthy's credentials might take me more seriously if I could demonstrate something beyond newspaper knowledge of the case. "Joe, what do you know about Monica Sonko?" I commenced my fact-finding mission. When he looked at me inquisitively, I added, "How did you come to rent her the cottage? I thought you didn't rent to singles."
"Usually don't," he nodded in agreement, "but one of the couples he usually takes couldn't make it this year. Rather than leave it empty for 2 weeks, I thought I'd give it a try. Besides, 'twasn't as if I didn't know her."
"You knew Monica Sonko?" The surprise in my voice immediately brought the dogs to full attention.
"Not directly." Joe quickly amended his original statement while Elizabeth wandered in his direction, and Teresa sighed and disappeared under the table again. "But I know her boss from way back."
"Who's her boss?"
I racked my brain for a possible answer.
"Harold Winthrop."
His reply took me by surprise again. "You lost me, Joe." I poured him a cup of tea and put a plate of cookies on the table. "I thought Harold Winthrop moved to Massachusetts years ago."
"He did. Started a company down there doing right well, from what I hear." The postmaster beamed down at the corgi now beaming up at him in anticipation.
"But why would he tell her about your cottage?"
I gave Elizabeth my best stop begging glare.
"Dunno, except maybe he thought of it 'cause young Harold and the missus now own the old family place. You know, that big place, Journey's End, up at the end of the lake."
"Young Harold? You mean Nerdo?"
It took all the zen I could muster to resist toppling the shamelessly begging canine with my bare foot.
"Guess that's what the kids used to call him." Joe picked up an organic, zero-trans fat, sugar-free cookie from the plate I'd placed in front of him, and Elizabeth's dark eyes gleamed covetously.
"Don't exactly know what a Nerdo is, but he strikes me as a right dim bulb who's right full of himself."
"I didn't know he was married." I didn't add that this probably occurred because I had heard nothing about the younger Winthrop since my two sons went off to college years ago.
"Yep, one of them long-legged model types."
Joe's eyes lit up as he described the young woman.
"Young Harold had a big do for us landholders to shore off when he was off at some meeting a while back. Right kind of him, I thought."
"So Harold Sr. called you about renting a place to Monica Sonko?" I reiterated in an effort to get the conversation off local gossip and back on serious fact-finding.
"Nope. She called me herself and said he told her I might know about something she could rent. Like I said, I wouldn't have done it if that couple hadn't backed out on me."
Joe shook his head sadly, and Elizabeth looked pretty sad too when he popped the last piece of the cookie into his mouth.
"Sure sorry I did, though."
"You know anything about her death?"
I seized the opportunity to zero in on my greatest concern.
"No more'n what I read in the papers, and that's more'n enough for me."
He eyed me curiously.
"Why?"
"You know how it is," I grinned at him. "Anything that involves animals and people interests me." no matter how bad or crazy it is. Sorry, can't help you there. Joe picked up another cookie, much to Elizabeth's delight. Police called me out to the cottage to see if anything was missing and give them the names of anyone at the lake who might know something. Then one of them gave me the name of a cleaning service run by an ex-cop who's supposed to clean up messes like that real good. And that was it. Was anything missing? I zeroed in on what I considered the most promising fact Joe volunteered. Nope, he dashed my hopes. Everything was fine except for the mess and the door that dog of hers ruined. He scowled so fiercely I immediately reminded him of the second reason the police called him to the cottage before he began ranting about pit bulls. So who's staying at the lake? I pursued this point while trying to ignore the fact that Elizabeth's owner's end taxing behavior had lured Teresa out from under the table. Anyone I know? Doubt it. They're all from out of state, mostly Massachusetts. His scowl faded as he gave me that highly abbreviated report of the lake residents while dunking his cookie in his tea. The locals all know it's not much of a lake and go somewheres else. So all the cottages are occupied now? I worded the same question another way in hopes of getting more specific information. Far as I know, Joe reported after a thoughtful interval that caused Teresa to sigh sympathetically. Only me and Eleanor and about 5 others do short-term rentals. All the others rent for the season. When that question still didn't yield the kind of detailed information I wanted, I approached the subject from Joe's area of expertise. With people coming and going all the time, it must be a headache delivering the mail to them. I hope the comment sounded more naive and less idiotic to him than it did to me. We only deliver to the few seasonals who don't have a P.O. box, he replied, automatically slipping into his role as the town's premier postal authority. The rest can use a box as landlords rent for them if they want. You rent a box for the cottage? Evidently something in my tone transformed my question into, do you want a cookie? Because Elizabeth rushed to my side and grinned up at me expectantly. Nope. We landlords rent one box for all of them, Joe informed me cheerfully as he beamed at the blatantly begging canine. So the people staying at 6 different cottages all use the same post office box? I thought Joe's revelation constituted a significant fact, but had no idea what to do with it, any more than I knew what to do with my begging dog at that moment. They can, but they don't, because most of them aren't around long enough to. We set it up because Eleanor and the other ladies thought it'd add a homey touch. Joe chuckled when he explained the reasoning behind the unusual and possibly illegal service. I sipped my tea while I pondered if and how I could get more information from him without arousing his suspicions. Come to think of it, though, that ain't completely true. His voice broke into my thoughts. Monica got mail there at least once, as I recall, and there's a couple of fellows who get it now and again, too. Regulars or new people? I jumped right in again. Both new, but one's kind of a hybrid. Joe looked at the dogs and the piece of cookie in his hand. One about your age rented Bobby Putnam's place for the month and stays there on and off. The other showed up about the same time Monica did. Where's the second one staying? I could tell by the look on Joe's face that I definitely raised his suspicions, and I immediately rushed to alleviate them. I'd like to talk to them to see if they noticed anything strange about the pit bull's behavior. You know how them dogs are sinning. He pointed the remainder of his cookie at me for emphasis. No, Joe, I don't. There are other dogs just as likely to bite a person as a pit bull, I countered, determined to make this point. I can see where you're coming from, but you'll never convince me. He evidently correctly picked up on my defensive feelings because he changed the subject abruptly. The younger one's staying at the Newcomb's Jay's Nest. How come you call him a hybrid? I asked while I mentally placed the cottage in question. JJ rents it for the season to the same folks every year, but they sublet to others on and off, Joe dutifully reported. JJ don't mind because there's never been no trouble. Although I desperately wanted to pump him for every possible detail about the two men who shared a mailbox with Monica Sonko, the curious way he studied me convinced me to drop the subject, lest another tale of the Widow Upton's strange behavior started making the rounds. Instead, I volunteered to separate and replant the thick clumps of artemisia at the cottage I knew Eleanor Talbot planned to propagate that summer. However, the majority of my mind focused on what I'd do when I finished that simple task. After I turned my back long enough for Joe to sneak the dog some cookie, he left and I prepared for my meeting with Chandler McCarthy. What does one wear to meet someone whose help one desires to investigate a murder no one believes was committed? I asked the assembled pets as I stared into my closet. Elizabeth peered into the closet with me for a while, but quickly lost interest when Maddie jumped her from behind. While Cat and Corgi rolled among my shoes, I opted for a multi-purpose black skirt, tailored white silk blouse, and beige linen blazer. "I hope seeing him isn't a mistake," I told Teresa as I picked pet hair out of my pantyhose. The old husky's somber expression indicated that I was, indeed, making a terrible mistake. But she always looked like that when I got ready to go out without her. Nonetheless, I had to admit I felt pretty somber myself when I thought about the meeting ahead. As I stood in the doorway surveying the crowd at the reception for new Hanover College faculty, I regretted not setting up a specific time to meet Chandler McCarthy, as well as some means of identification. True to the school's firmly entrenched Ivy League roots, practically all the men present wore conservative blazers or sports coats, dress shirts, and ties. What few bucked the system with their spiked hair and earrings looked more like punk rockers than academics. Although I couldn't be certain, I strongly suspected that a man with McCarthy's credentials would be part of the former group, if he were even there at all. That meant he could be any one of the more than 30 men in that category scattered around the room. After a general sweep of the room revealed no male who looked like he was looking for me, I drifted from the periphery of one conversational group to another in hopes of picking up something that would hint at my target's presence. Somehow I couldn't imagine him as any of the men in the group discussing 16th century feminist attitudes. Nor could I envision him among those engaged in a sprightly debate about values clarification for entering freshmen, monetary revisionism, whatever the hell that was, or the college's dedication to multicultural centrism, which, from what I could gather the few minutes I listened, meant they wanted money to build another building. At least I sincerely hoped Chandler McCarthy wasn't among them. Try as I might, I couldn't imagine discussing Monica and Harley with a man who enjoyed any of those subjects. Their problem definitely didn't fit with feminism, values clarification, or multicultural centrism. It might fit with monetary revisionism for all I knew, but I doubted it. I leaned against the wall, folded my arms across my chest, and scanned the area again. When I did, I noticed a man on the opposite side of the room, leaning against the wall with his arms folded across his chest, surveying the crowd. I immediately knew who he was. Before I lost my nerve, I crossed the room, extended my right hand, and greeted him with the customary, "Dr. McCarthy, I'm Sinclair Upton." "I know." He shook my hand firmly while studying me with the most incredibly blue eyes. I immediately wondered how he knew who I was, and, in what I quickly discovered was an unnerving habit of his, he answered my question before I had a chance to ask it. "I don't believe I've ever seen anyone move so quickly from monetary revisionism to multicultural centrism before," he informed me crisply. That seemed the behavior of a veterinarian with a few goat questions. Even though I found his accurate assessment of my behavior somewhat irritating, I nodded politely. I then turned my attention to the man himself. Contrary to my mental image, his more than 6-foot frame towered over my not quite 5'4", and his somewhat undisciplined graying hair leaned more toward liberal length than the crew cut I'd envisioned as de rigueur for the literary darling of the law enforcement and intelligence communities. "You're a lot, smaller than I thought you'd be," he announced, a politically incorrect statement I would have challenged had I not been just as politically incorrectly thinking how much bigger he was than I thought he'd be. "Now tell me about the goat." The abrupt change of subject momentarily disoriented me, and it took me a minute to pull my thoughts together. "I'm the one with the questions for you, remember?" I tactfully reminded him. and what I soon discovered was yet another of his many annoying habits. McCarthy stared at a point directly above my head, then suddenly dropped his gaze and stared directly at me. A very valuable pygmy goat was recently stolen from a research facility in Massachusetts, he stated quietly.
Oh?
I slapped on my most innocent expression. It was fed a microtagment. He curved his body over mine as I leaned against the wall, I assumed to keep his remarks confidential. Nonetheless, I found the confining gesture unsettling.
A what?
I could feel my innocent facade begin to ravel a little around the edges. A microtagant. He hovered even more closely when he repeated the word. Microscopic bits of multicolored plastic, like those you emailed me about, Dr. Upton.
Ah, yes, a microtagant.
I, too, repeated the word in what I hoped sounded like a knowledgeable professional's voice. In the few minutes we've been talking, I realized that Chandler McCarthy was one very focused individual and that, for whatever reason, he was very focused on that goat. Although I couldn't be sure, it seemed likely that once I told him what I knew about that goat, he wouldn't be nearly so willing to give me his full attention. Because I was much more focused on Monica's killer than that goat, I couldn't let that happen. However, before we discuss the goat with the microtagant, I smiled up at him politely, we need to discuss another matter first.
Which is?
He raised both his voice and left eyebrow slightly in a manner that strongly suggested he was unaccustomed to not getting his own way. I have this little problem. I started to tell him about Monica and Harley, then noticed a woman in an Armani knockoff observing us with more than what I considered casual interest. "Do you mind if we go somewhere more private to discuss this?" I said instead. He gave me a somewhat perturbed look, but gestured toward the door. Once we walked across the broad campus green, I began again. "I'll help you find your goat if you help me find out who killed a client of mine." I was so caught up in my desire to get the part of the conversation about Monica's relationship with Harley over with, I gave nary a thought to the possibility that someone with his background might find this introductory remark unusual.
"What?"
he explained sufficiently loudly. I wondered if the practically empty green would be private enough. "Everyone thinks my client's dog killed her, but I don't believe it." I calmly stated what I considered the most critical fact of the matter. McCarthy ran his hand through his slightly longer than conservative length hair and gave me the first indication that he and I might experience some communication problems.
"What in the bloody hell are you talking about?"
"Monica Sonko was my client." I kept my voice neutral even though I was irked by his apparent ignorance of the front page case. "The woman supposedly killed by her dog at Somerset Lake." His face cleared. "Oh, yes, by the Spitz," he mumbled distractedly. I froze mid-step and stared at him. He turned and looked at me inquisitively. "Don't you know the difference between a Spitz and a pit bull?" That never-considered possibility struck me as more of a liability than an asset under the circumstances. "Probably, if I thought about it," he answered, looking very thoughtful. "But to tell the truth, I never felt the need to. Should I now?"
"You'd better if you want to know about that goat. How can I ask someone who doesn't know the difference between a Spitz and a pit bull to investigate a murder?"
"And if I do tell you, dare I hope you might give me the whole story?" McCarthy's sarcasm, to say nothing of his very accurate evaluation of the situation, shocked me. "Not until you tell me the difference between a Spitz and a pit bull," I repeated firmly while wondering just how much of the whole story I'd have to tell him. He semi-glared at me and I managed a semi-decent semi-glare back. Then he furrowed his brow as he evidently scrolled through years of mental files. "Spitzes are white yappy dogs and pit bulls are sort of squash-nosed fighting dogs," he finally reported, obviously summoning the answers from a very meager mental file. "Now tell me about your client and a pit bull. Everything." Although I'd found his answer barely adequate, I reminded myself that I hadn't selected him from a particularly crowded pool of potential investigators. Armed with that rather pitiful reassurance, I gestured toward a bench. After we were seated, I told him everything about Monica Sonko and Harley. As I'd feared, he went into denial. "You expect me to believe that she and her dog were..." He stared at me incredulously. "Yes." I confirmed his suspicions while uttering a silent prayer that McCarthy's mind was at least as liberal as his hair length, and preferably a lot more so, then further explained why I concluded this. "That's what she told me, and it fits. I don't see any reason why she should ask me to come see her and the dog and then lie. Why did she decide to get help?" Curiosity turned his blue eyes smoky gray. "Two reasons," I answered, feeling much more confident now that I'd given him what I considered the most disturbing piece of the puzzle. "One," I held up one finger to emphasize my first point, "she was so embarrassed by the relationship she didn't want to ask anyone in her own area for help. And the second reason," he held up two fingers and arched that same eyebrow again, "she'd met a guy and fallen in love and wanted the dog acting normally as quickly as possible." He appeared more stunned by each new fact I supplied and shook his head as if to clear it. "McCarthy, she wasn't a pervert. The memory of my client's considerable distress when she described her relationship with her dog caused my maternal instincts to surge protectively. She was a timid young woman who got caught up in something out of ignorance and loneliness and didn't know how to get out of it." "How can you be so sure there was a new man in her life?" His challenge of this part of Monica's story surprised me. "She told me so, and I can't think of any reason why she'd lie to me about that, either." The pained expression that momentarily flitted across McCarthy's face clearly communicated that he found the idea of a new man in Monica Sonko's life as troubling as her relationship with her dog, a fact I tucked away for future reference. "So she didn't call you because she thought she was in any danger?" "From what she told me, the relationship with the dog was relatively stable." I introduced this information tentatively to see how my companion would interpret it. That same eyebrow went up in a manner that strongly suggested he felt incapable of interpreting it at all. "She didn't call me because the dog was doing anything different." I tried another approach. "You know, like biting her." When I saw those blue eyes widen, I knew that remark had sent his thoughts spinning off in some lewd direction. "For crying out loud, McCarthy, get your mind out of the gutter. I'm not talking about some tawdry porn flick here," I chided him disgustedly. "I'm talking about a human-animal relationship that got out of hand, the likes of which you can find discussed in any one of a number of professional texts and journals. It wasn't until she fell in love and realized she could lose the guy if he found out about the dog that she got over her fear about asking for help." "But why wouldn't she seek help? Because of, well, because of the impropriety of it." "Be serious. Think about her position. Ask the average person what they think about people who have that kind of relationship with a dog. Most of them will tell you flat out they're perverts who ought to be shot. How many people would have the guts to confess such a relationship knowing that? Monica did the best she could, given her personality and lack of knowledge." "You talk like you knew her very well." McCarthy's statement came precariously close to being an accusation. "Not nearly as well as I knew her dog." "What does knowing the dog have to do with it?" McCarthy's failure to grasp the essence of everything I told him, coupled with his seeming lack of compassion, made me want to punch him. "It has everything to do with it, damn it. Because I knew that dog, I know he didn't kill her. So maybe one of those 100% all-natural, socially acceptable men you evidently consider so damn proper did." My outburst caused McCarthy to recoil slightly, but he recovered immediately and shot back. "And exactly how did you come to know the dog?" "Because it's my job," I replied. "Look, McCarthy, people don't love their dogs, even in the most socially acceptable sense, because the dogs attack them. They love them because they're always waiting for them to get home, always happy to see them, eternally grateful for a bowl of food, willing to forgive them for just about anything. You have to admit it's hardly unnatural to be attracted to an individual with those qualities." He grudgingly nodded, and I continued. Most human-canine relationships never cross any serious lines, but when they do, some people, like Monica, want to believe it's only a dog problem, not a canine and human one. The dog does that and you call it a human problem? Yes, because she could have stopped it at any time if she hadn't been afraid to do it. But you said he didn't try to bite her, he persisted. Why would she be afraid of him if that wasn't the case? Because she was a timid person who didn't like to make choices about anything, let alone something as complicated as this. Because before the boyfriend showed up, the dog was her best and maybe only friend. Because she knew nothing about canine behavior and had no idea that what most people considered his ordinary behaviors might communicate dominance in her particular situation. What behaviors? McCarthy asked the question I'd hoped he wouldn't. Jumping on her, licking her, when she got out of the shower, sleeping in her bed. I could tell the instant his meticulous mind put it all together, and I reiterated my previous point. But if just once she'd mustered the confidence to take control of the situation, he would have backed down. I'm sure of that. The thought of the consequences of all those missed opportunities and how I'd planned to give Monica, Sonko, and Harley just such a chance flashed through my mind, and I couldn't speak for a minute. She was a tiny, fearful woman, McCarthy, I finally got out. He was a big, exuberant dog. It happens. He stared off in the distance for a while before he spoke again. You're telling me that out of ignorance, this woman gave her dog control over her. At the same time, you want me to believe that he wouldn't attack her? I nodded in agreement and prayed that would satisfy him. But it didn't. Instead, he asked the question I suspect every thinking law enforcement officer in the world would ask. But why wouldn't the dog attack her? Because there was no need to. I articulated the truth that was so clear to me when I observed the young woman and her dog, but which I knew few other people would recognize at all. McCarthy studied me for a very long moment before he said something that completely stunned me. So what's that got to do with the goat? The hell with your goat! All I care about is the dog. But the goat's part of the deal, he reminded me with a degree of calmness that made me feel like a raving maniac. You tell me where the goat is, and I'll find out who killed your client. The latter unanticipated remark caused me to whip toward him immediately. Then it's a deal? I leaned toward him expectantly, practically daring him to try to retract his words. He seemed surprised when I pursued the point so quickly, but even a brain-dead amoeba couldn't deny my attempt to pin him down because he'd raised the issue himself. It's a deal. He finally agreed far more grumpily than politely. Now where's the goat? Unfortunately, I hadn't really given the idea that he might actually expect me to know something about the goat much thought, because I had been too busy trying to come up with an acceptable way to discuss my dead client's activities with a stranger. I don't know. I said in a manner I hope conveyed something other than that I didn't know. It's a very valuable animal that requires special care. He gave me an inscrutable, more amphibious than mammalian look when he accused me of lying. Every minute counts. If you think I know where it is, you're wrong. I know it was at the cottage with Monica, and I know it was alive when it was there. Why? When he asked that, he definitely looked like an iguana, a snookered, blue-eyed one. Because the urine and droppings I found there were relatively fresh, I reported, alas, without thinking. I take it you discovered the microtaggant when you examined the droppings? He skewered me with his very blue eyes. That question told me exactly where McCarthy's train of thought was heading, but I couldn't think of any way to derail it. Rather than fuel the process, I merely nodded in agreement. Do you still have the samples, Dr. Upton? The skewer routine became so intense I clutched the bench to keep from trembling with anxiety when I nodded my head in the opposite direction. Where are they? His expression became even more intense, something I would have thought impossible until he actually did it. I toyed with the idea of telling him about sending some of the samples to Jim Godfrey's lab, but rejected it until I knew him better. Instead, I opted for a half-truth I hoped would convince him of my willingness to uphold my part of the bargain. "Someone stole them," I admitted to a fat mourning dove waddling by, rather than establish eye contact with my new partner.
"What?"
His astonished exclamation shot out so explosively, I took some small consolation in knowing that, whatever his other vices, Chandler McCarthy evidently hadn't stolen my lettuce crisper. That, in turn, led me to elaborate. "I put them in my refrigerator." I initially looked at him, but then looked away again after I noticed his well-concealed, but nonetheless increasing agitation. "I'm pretty sure whoever took them was the same person who clobbered me at Monica's cottage."
"What?"
"And probably the same person who cut me and cut the bloodstain out of my shirt, too. I'm not so sure when that happened, at the cottage or after I got home. I didn't notice it until after I came to the second time." I figured I might as well give him all of the bad news as long as he was having a spell anyhow. But I did convey it to the now highly suspicious dove rather than establish contact with the two very blue eyes attempting to bore holes into the side of my head. Those revelations caused him to leap from the bench as if shot from a cannon, frighten the dove into clumsy flight, and bellow, "Do you have any?" But then he suddenly shut his mouth and sat down again.
"I'll take care of it," he announced abruptly.
"You mean you'll help me find out what happened to Monica?" Such a tremendous wave of gratitude washed over me, it almost brought tears to my eyes.
"No, I'll find out what happened and tell you," declared my new partner in a condescending tone. "Go home and bake cookies or something." "Bake cookies, my ass!"
Obviously the man had some sort of death wish, particularly if he intended to eat any cookies I baked. Baking is one of several domestic skills I never mastered.
"I thought you wanted my help."
He gave me a piercing look that implied that no one with half a brain would disagree with him.
"I do want your help, but you barely know the difference between a spitz and a pit bull, and next to nothing about how humans and animals interact."
His almost subliminal recoil told me loudly and clearly that this particular point was as clear to him as it was to me. So I gave him another verbal hit to drive it home more firmly. "And how long's it been since you've actually been around a real live goat rather than just molecules of one, McCarthy?"
20 years?
Longer?
Naturally, I didn't mention that real-life goats didn't show up that often in my line of work, either.
Another, infinitesimally small recoil encouraged me to shore up my position. "I'll interview the lake residents and find out what they know about Monica and her dog. Then you can discuss it with your police pals off the record or whatever and find out who really killed her." He traded in the infinitesimal recoil for a faintly interested expression that encouraged me to continue. "You have to admit that people are more likely to reveal animal-related information to me than to you." I pointed out this obvious shortcoming on his part deliberately, but kindly. "And naturally, I'll get in touch with you the minute I find out anything that might pertain to your goat, too." I added this more as an afterthought, but I hoped he wouldn't notice. However, I suspect he did notice because he nodded his head very slowly, as if he really didn't want to agree with me, but couldn't think of any way to get out of it. He reluctantly removed a Hanover College business card from his wallet, wrote his home address and phone number on the back of it in neat script, and handed it to me. I stuffed it in my bag and thanked him for his cooperation. As I headed across the green toward the lot where I'd parked my car, I turned to steal one final look at my new partner, only to lock eyes with his for one interminably long, unfathomable moment.
You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.